This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Barring a last-minute curveball from the federal courts, Indiana will be one of only four states without expanded vote-by-mail for the 2020 general election amid an ongoing pandemic. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on how the state got to this point and where it might go from here.
Governor Eric Holcomb declared a public health emergency over COVID-19 on March 6th. 2 weeks later, before he issued an expansive stay-at-home order, Holcomb postponed the primary election from May to June. And the Indiana Election Commission expanded the state's vote-by-mail system, allowing any eligible voter to cast their ballot that way for the primary. That was done in agreement with the Indiana Republican and Democratic Party leaders and Secretary of State Connie Lawson.
All of these steps will be in concert to ensure that our election process will continue and that every eligible voter is given the opportunity to vote.
People took advantage. More Hoosiers voted absentee than on Election Day. A few months later, things have changed.
We are going forward with a normal election process here in Indiana. We will not be making changes like we did in the primary since the stay-at-home order has been lifted.
There are about a dozen reasons you can still legally vote by mail, including if you're 65 or older, if you're working or will be absent from your county the entire time polls are open on Election Day, or if you're confined to your home. But despite repeated calls, a vote at the Indiana Election Commission, and a lawsuit, Republican leaders have refused to expand the system for the general election. They argue with so many people back to work and going out in public, there's no need for more mail-in options. And they insist in-person voting is safe. Governor Holcomb also suggests another reason.
We also deserve to have a very timely election results. We call it election day, not election month.
Indiana Democratic Party Chair John Zody doesn't buy it. He says it's purely political hypocrisy.
I think there's been a terrible dereliction of duty by the state administration and all those Republicans who claim to be patriots and advocates for the right to vote when they are basically suppressing it as we speak.
If there are political calculations behind Republicans' decision not to expand vote by mail, political scientist Laura Wilson says those calculations don't make much sense.
Other states do have mail-in voting entirely. So we've been able to look at those states and confirm, in fact, it does not benefit any party over another. Both parties have their own demographics that would benefit in their own way from mail-in voting.
And there are Hoosier Republicans fighting to expand it, including with the advocacy group Indiana Vote by Mail. It's headed by Barbara Tully, who is part of the fight this year, sued the state, so far unsuccessfully, to force it to expand mail-in voting this fall. But Tully says the change she really wants isn't temporary, it's permanent.
Indiana has very low voter turnout rates when you rank us amongst all 50 states, and we need to do something to improve that. Vote by mail as an option for voters to use if they choose to brings more people into the electoral process.
Tully says her organization will push the General Assembly to expand vote by mail when it reconvenes in 2021. Laura Wilson says the spotlight on mail-in voting this year could help that cause.
Because I think a lot of people will say, but really, why don't we have it? It brings to the forefront the challenges we have with the current system. And individuals who may not have cared about it otherwise, may not have used it otherwise, it may not have applied to them otherwise. Certainly everything about this year is different, and that's true for the election cycle as well. It might get them thinking about it in a different way.
The Indiana Senate easily passed a bill to expand vote by mail just 2 years ago, but that measure, sponsored by a Republican, died without a vote in the House. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
There's a lot of COVID-19 data that is available through state and federal resources, but those numbers can be confusing or maybe even raise questions. So that's inspired some people to do their own data tracking. How's that done? Well, Side Effect Public Media Natalie Krebs found out.
Every morning, Sarah Willett logs onto Twitch, a platform typically used for live streaming games, and gets to work live streaming spreadsheets.
Okay, so I'm going to quickly update because I've had a few reports.
Willett lives in Ames, Iowa, and spends hours every day creating tables and graphs for her own COVID-19 website. She says it presents data in a way that's much easier to grasp than on the state's official website.
So they don't have to go jump into a tiny link at the bottom of the main page to see how many hospitalizations there are in their county. They don't have to calculate out what percentage of their county is infected. These are data points, statistics that are missing on the state site.
Willett has been collecting data since Iowa announced its first COVID-19 cases in March. She has a rare immunodeficiency that makes her more susceptible to getting sick, and the information eases her anxiety. She thinks it does the same for others because her site gets thousands of hits daily.
There's a lot of us who are data literate that facts and science and data makes us think more clearly and understand whether or not it's safe to go to the grocery store on a Tuesday.
Willett isn't the only person who has spent hours analyzing COVID-19 numbers around the country. In March, a pair of journalists teamed up with a software developer to launch the COVID-19 tracking project. They currently have hundreds of volunteers who update their website with figures across the country. And as the new academic year started, a Kansas teacher built a nationwide database of COVID cases at schools. After it went viral, the National Education Association took over her project. Dana Jones is another data detective. The nurse practitioner in eastern Iowa made national headlines in August when she revealed a glitch in the state's COVID-19 tracking system. She discovered that it was incorrectly backdating thousands of cases. Jones says she had been tracking numbers just as a concerned citizen.
I was trying to, really understand how the pandemic was evolving and changing and trying to kind of gauge my own personal safety and the safety of my family based on trends.
Iowa officials have defended their online database, saying numbers sometimes shift around because they're updating statistics in real time. And though some health experts say independent trackers play a crucial role in checking government figures, they also approach those findings with caution. Megan Srinivas is an infectious disease specialist in Fort Dodge, Iowa.
I mean, there's always a concern as to what the validity of their findings are, what they're basing their data on. And that's exactly why I'm very hesitant to automatically say so-and-so is right or so-and-so is the person you should follow until I've had a chance to verify it myself, talk to them thoroughly.
Willett, a former administrative assistant, says that's why transparency is important and why she live streams the daily process of updating her website.
I don't want there ever to be the thought process that I'm taking data from somewhere else and my numbers are different than the state's numbers.
She says her husband, a doctor trained in biostatistics, double checks her findings. Recently, Willett contracted with the Iowa State Education Association to create a database of cases in the state's K-12 schools. This was after Iowa said it would not be creating its own. Willett says she's not motivated by the new paycheck.
Even at the end of the day, I've worked 16, 18 hours straight. I still feel good, knowing that I'm helping other people and I'm making it so that they can make the decisions they need.
Willett says she'll keep tracking numbers for the rest of the pandemic. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Natalie Krebs.
So how are things? Family good?
Yeah. Yeah, they're doing well.
Hey, we missed you at the game last week. Is everything all right?
I just haven't been feeling like me lately.
Okay. You know I'm here for you, right? And there's support too.
That's a cut. Beautiful, fellas. Beautiful.
Acting is one thing. Talking about suicide in real life is another.
In the military, you take challenges head on.
And now it's your turn to do the same for our veterans.
Be there for someone you care about.
Learn how you can start the conversation at betheretherforveterans.com.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. This is Suicide Prevention Month here across the country and here in Northwest Indiana. And U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs is recognizing this month as a way to help reach out to veterans that may be having problems, some of the small problems that turn into big ones. They're trying to get through difficult times to be sure anyway with the coronavirus pandemic, but then their own physical health gets in the way. Let's find out more about the program, which is called Be There for Veterans. We have with us Michelle Langlois, who is the Suicide Prevention Coordinator for the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center, which is our regional VA hospital in Chicago. And Michelle, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Tell us first about the creation of the Be There for Veterans program, how it got started, and what it does help veterans and their loved ones know how to deal with the possibility of suicide.
So the hashtag Be There program is a national VA program for veterans, and a lot of times people don't are not aware of what they can do to assist a veteran if they're in crisis or if they're struggling with thoughts of suicide. And so it gives very tangible ideas and ways to support your local veterans in your community, your family members that are veterans, and so very simple things that you can do to help a veteran that actually really does go a long way that people don't realize would be something like send them a text saying, you know, how are, you know, just thinking of you, how are you doing today, or a phone call as well. You know, a lot of people not sure what to say or kind of how to reach out. It, very simple things of just letting them know that you're thinking about them, letting them know that you're there, asking if they need anything, if they want to talk. Those things actually go quite a long way with getting people to feel that support. Support is a really important thing in order to reduce suicide and suicidal thoughts in people. And so reaching out with just very tangible kind of caring contacts is really important and very simple for any of us can do. Some other things with like Be There, the concept of Be There, hashtag Be There, is little things to really help a veteran out that are very tangible, such as sometimes people don't have childcare to go to their appointments. So, you know, offering to watch their children when they go into an appointment at the VA or if they get their care in the community, you know, going out for coffee. I know that's a little trickier now.
Yeah.
But, you know, people can get there, bring their own coffee, and they can go for a walk outside, you know, in social distance appropriately, but just so they have that kind of social connection and that support. Working out with somebody, again, a lot of people are working out in parks and doing things like that or running. So, again, with COVID, you can still do those kinds of things where you go for a walk with another individual to show that support through just companionship and, you know, connection. And it doesn't seem like a lot. It doesn't seem like that would reduce suicide in anyone, but it actually does, and it actually works very effectively. So we really want people to kind of realize there are very practical, tangible things you can do with the loved ones in your life that are veterans or in the community to try to reduce suicide.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, let's take a moment. Let's give out the Veterans Crisis Line phone number. And obviously, if you call the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center first get into the phone system, you're given the number. So if you have problems, if you've had thoughts about suicide, or you have a family member that's in that situation, they can call the number. But what is that suicide, that Veterans Crisis Line that will help deal with suicides?
Yes, the Veterans Crisis Line is a wonderful resource. The phone number is 800-273-8255, and then you would press 1 to get to the Veterans Crisis Line. Mm-hmm. If you did call Jesse Brown or the Crown Point Clinic or any of our clinics, actually, they would provide the number, but you don't even need to hang up and call that number. You would just press 7, and you can automatically be transferred directly to the crisis line, because we don't necessarily want a veteran in crisis to have any kind of delay. We want to make sure that they get to our crisis line immediately.
Now, what seem to be the I guess you could call them red flags, things that someone should note about if somebody that they know, or themselves for that matter, or a loved one, is having a problem and they do need help? What are those things that we should look for?
So I'm really glad you asked that. When I do try to provide training for civilians and regular folks, a lot of people will admit that they don't really know what to look for, and that's part of the problem. So there's a lot of different signs to look for. So somebody that might be going through a crisis in their life currently, so that might be relationship issues, legal problems, new onset of a medical issue, chronic pain. Those are some risk factors that we see. People who might, you know, drink at a normal level, but then their drinking increases, their use of drugs increases, so you see an increase in drugs and alcohol in their behaviors. People who might display depressed mood or hopelessness,
or feelings of worthlessness. I know some people during COVID have had more anxiety, have had more depression. So this would be something that you don't maybe normally see with somebody normally displaying these changes in their mood. And some behaviors that you might see would be something like taking more risky chances in life. So driving really erratically, going on their motorcycle at hundreds of miles per hour with no helmet, not really caring if they get a crash. Again, misusing drugs or alcohol to the point where it's very dangerous. Sometimes people will get their affairs in order. So you'll see people who will, you know, start signing certain things over to a family member, and it wouldn't be under normal circumstances. That should be very concerning for folks. People who start talking more about death or dying frequently might be struggling with those thoughts. So a lot of changes in their behavior, a lot of changes in their mood to more depressed or anxious moods, talks of death and dying. Try to make sure I'm hitting everything. Usually it's a pretty big stressor going on in their life, but not always. Sometimes there's nothing that's kind of an acute stressor. Then people can very much start struggling with these mood changes and these thoughts of suicide. Most people don't necessarily tell you they're having thoughts of suicide, so it's very strongly encouraged that if you see somebody with some of these risk factors, that you do ask the question. And the question being very simple, are you having any thoughts of death recently? Especially if you hear them talking about that, can you tell me more about that? Are you having any thoughts of suicide? People are afraid to ask sometimes. They feel like they're planting that idea, but they're not. A lot of people are struggling and not telling people because there is a stigma. So if you ask that question, that now allows that veteran to reach out and get the care and the support that they need to help them through that crisis.
Now, Michelle, if you will, from the standpoint of the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center in Chicago, what special programs, if there are any, that are set up here that go along with the general programs dealing with thoughts of suicide or suicide prevention in general?
So every VA actually has a suicide prevention program. At Jesse Brown, we have 6 suicide prevention coordinators. We have 4 that are located at the Jesse Brown VA in Chicago. We have 1 specific suicide prevention coordinator at Crown Point Clinic because it's quite a large clinic. And then we have another suicide prevention coordinator at the Illinois clinics. We have 3 smaller clinics in the state of Illinois in the Chicago area. And so we kind of spread out our team to make sure that any veteran in any of those communities has somebody with that expertise is easily available. We work very closely, our team, with, so one thing that our program does is we do quite a bit of things, but one thing that we do is we monitor veterans that are identified as higher risk for suicide so that we give them that extra support in case management and crisis intervention during that time when they're struggling and make sure they get all the resources they can at Jesse Brown in order to get them safely through that crisis and then get them to a better way of life and no longer having those suicidal thoughts. We work very collaboratively with all the mental health programs, substance abuse programs, and even the medical programs at the VA in order to make sure those veterans are getting all that they need that can help them out this crisis. Because as I mentioned earlier, there's certain things that trigger people. It's not all the same, and so those crises are going to be different, and there's going to need different resources to address those crises. So, but we have a phenomenal amount of mental health services from PTSD services, specifically regular outpatient mental health. We have residential programs for substance abuse and mental health. We have a partial hospitalization program we call Day Hospital, which we have folks from Indiana who will go that far as well. Right now, most of that's virtual. But that's a very popular program for folks who are definitely struggling right now but maybe not need to be in the hospital. So they go every day to that program. So we have just a phenomenal amount of programming and things that are available for our veterans. So one thing that is important for people to know is that a veteran can go and be seen on the very same day without an appointment. They can be seen by a clinician, a psychiatrist, and they can even be started on medications if that's something the veteran's interested in on that very same day. And that's something very difficult to do in the private sector.
Right, that's right.
And so definitely if you know of a veteran or you're a veteran that's kind of struggling, you can come into the Crown Point Clinic, you can come into Jesse Brown, and we can see you on the same day and get you started.
Have you gotten any feedback where there may be in extreme cases where some consulting, talking with somebody, using the crisis line, dealing with the suicide, has helped save somebody's life?
The way the crisis line works is there's a responder that will answer that call immediately, and then they will refer that veteran, with the veteran's permission, to the local suicide prevention program. So every day we get a list of veterans who called in Northwest Indiana or in Chicago area, and we reach out to them. One of us will reach out to them the next day. And we get a lot of really good feedback from the veterans. They say that they felt a lot better after they talked to the responder. You know, it was really helpful. Because I will ask that question to make sure we're giving the best service that we can.
Mm-hmm.
And so we definitely have gotten a lot of really good feedback from our veterans from the that do reach out to the crisis line. And we've definitely had a lot of veterans who have told us that they have been very helpful, that they have saved, they felt that they saved their life. I've had that be communicated to me by some veterans as well. And the family members can call as well. And so sometimes family members are not sure how to help a veteran. You can call that number as well, and they'll be very happy to talk to you and try to see what they can do to help the veteran that you know, that's in your family mm-hmm. or that's a loved one of yours.
Well, Michelle Langlois, thank you very much for being with us and telling us not only about the problems and the problem signs of that can lead to suicide and to be able to prevent suicides from happening, and about what all the actions is being set up and the programs at the Jesse Brown VA Center.
Thank you for having me.
Michelle Langlois is a suicide prevention coordinator at the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center in Chicago. And this is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
The once grand and still historic Valparaiso Mansion, known most recently as the White House Restaurant, is set for demolition, weather permitting, today. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson spoke with Brandon Dickinson, the Director of Redevelopment for the City of Valparaiso, about the history of the building, why it's coming down, and any future plans for the property.
The building dates back to William Calkins, who was a merchant inventor of the Calkins washer. It had a hand aggregator, and apparently that was a new item back then. That was the crown jewel of inventions in the 19th century. So he made a lot of money off of that invention, and he built the home right after the Civil War, around 1865. It was a sprawling estate, and based on the topography, had been labeled Calkins Hill because the building kind of sat alone up there. And then in about 1880, the president of Valparaiso University, President Brown, actually purchased it and used it as his home, as the president's home. And he entertained a number of historical guests, including William Jennings Bryan. President Taft visited the home, as well as Irish President Eamon de Valray. And so it became kind of an important place for the university to utilize for guests and dignitaries, rather. And then in about 1917, President Brown died, and it went into a bit of a family dispute for about 20 years, where it culminated in the family subdividing the surrounding property, selling off to other homes, and then they actually converted the house. It was a 21-room house, and they converted it at that time into multifamily housing apartments. And then it served that purpose until about 1944, when a local family, the Pappas family, they purchased it, and they actually used it as their private residence until about 1978. It was too big of a house for them, and the insurance and the costs to live there were starting to get pretty high, so they actually came up with the idea of turning it into a restaurant. So in about 1978, it was converted into the White House Restaurant that the Pappas family ran. They put a bar down in the basement, and they made some other minor adjustments to the house, but it was basically seen as a place to go get a family meal, a restaurant in a family setting, in a nice home, very stately, fireplaces, chandeliers, et cetera. And the restaurant did very well. In about 1995, the family decided to close the restaurant and didn't really do anything with it. And then in 1998, there was a fire, And between the fire and the water damage, it kind of sealed the building's fate, where it was pretty expensive to try and convert back into a restaurant with those damages. And so eventually it went into the hands of someone who ran a small banquet space, and it unfortunately didn't do very well, and so it kind of fell again onto hard times. And then again, just over due to prior damage and lack of use, the building and house kind of fell into disrepair. A lot of deferred maintenance occurred there, so it just became much more expensive to revamp the house than it would be worth from any type of commercial offering. And so it fell into disrepair, further disrepair, and that's the condition that it's in today. It's basically been turned into, we've had squatters in there. It's been fairly used, unfortunately, by people that shouldn't be using it. It's become a public safety concern for the area. And the good news here is that the ownership has had people that have an interest in preserving some of the features of the house, like the staircase. The original staircase was actually donated to a family that had removed it and had installed it into their home in a nearby house, and as well as some of the chandeliers. So they've basically let anybody that had any type of sentimental interest in the house, in the restaurant, come in, and they could take anything of value so that it could be preserved by people that appreciated it. And so that's kind of left it rather bare bones. And now, while it's unfortunately a disappointing structure today, there's interest in converting that building, demolishing the building because it's beyond salvage, and actually turning it into a beautiful development that would feature brownstone dual-loaded homes that you probably would be used to seeing in Wrigleyville and some of those other Chicago suburbs, and giving new life to this beautiful location at a very important intersection of our community.
Where is the intersection? Does it sit in the heart of downtown?
It sits, it's in downtown. It's just a block north of Lincoln Way, Lincoln Way being the main thoroughfare through Valparaiso. So it is just basically a block north of dead center downtown Valparaiso.
So nobody ever wanted to turn that building into a museum or anything? Nothing historical, that like a tourist attraction of sorts?
I believe there were conversations about whether that would be viable, and obviously the Porter County Museum and the Porter County Historical Society have all had varying levels of interest in the building, but unfortunately there was never enough of an impetus to go forward and try and do something to maybe put that as a museum or as a location. Again, just due to the lack, due to the damage rather, there just was a real lack of value in trying to get in there. A lot of the original materials had been damaged in that fire and putting the fire out. So a lot of that was not salvageable, unfortunately, because there, when you look on the outside, it doesn't necessarily look as bad as you might think. But when you get to the interior, you can see very, very starkly how bad the building has gone into with no one keeping the house up.
That's Brandon Dickinson, the Valparaiso City Redevelopment Director, talking about the old White House restaurant property that's coming down. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we have a conversation with the Times business reporter and author, Joseph Pete. He has a new book out. We'll find out more about it. And a little later, we'll also have a conversation with the Lake County Elections Board and Voter Registration Director Michelle Fayman, a look at the 2020 general election. Hope you can join us for tomorrow's program.